Could be.
F1, F2, F off, F off, F off, to F off, F to F off, back to Russia, back to Russia. F off, back to Russia. F off, back to Russia.
last night. Once again I had the dream. I tossed and I turned. That old feeling still the same. It was so real. I woke up cold and sweating. I wondered, did I call her name? In the dream, she was right there with me. Right there with me in the bed. She said, Bobby, come and kiss me. Never leave me is what she said. But when I reached out to hold her, oh, I woke my wife instead. I've seen her. We'll be right back.
WRCT, Pittsburgh.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
Yeah, so that's, I got a call to illustrate a celebrity children's book, and they told me who it was for, and I my jaw dropped.
Mm-hmm.
And we communicated via Zoom and the phone chats and all that. And I poured my whole self into that, because back in SVA, they trained us for everything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they had classes for children's book illustration, storyboards, animation, all kinds of stuff. And I took classes that would prepare me for the possibility of doing a children's book. I didn't know it was ever going to happen, but if it did, I was ready to do it. And so when Scholastic and Colin chose me for this, I knew exactly what to do. It was just about finding the right style for what a young Colin Kaepernick was going to look like.
Eric Wilkerson, a Chelsea Award-winning illustrator and concept artist, an illustrator of I Color Myself Different, a children's picture book written by athlete and activist Colin Kaepernick. This book has opened a conversation the author has been thinking about since grabbing a pack of crayons to color his self-portrait back in elementary school. One day, while in elementary class, he was given a simple school assignment: draw a picture of yourself and your family. What young Kaepernick did next with his brown crayon would change his worldview and his world. Being both the author and illustrator's first picture book, there are more reasons than one to celebrate this effort. One being his message of being proud of what makes us different. I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, I Color Myself Different with illustrator Eric Wilkerson, In Black America.
I was talking with everybody, Colin, his team, Scholastic, and it was a whole labor of love for everybody involved, and making sure that the pages were what Colin wanted to see, what Scholastic wanted to see, and making sure everybody was happy with it. And I was a real learning process for me, because I didn't know, there's a number of things that I wasn't really aware of, but mm-hmm. I kind of just learned on the job. So I was really honored that they gave me that opportunity, because they could have gone with anybody.
One can only imagine what it felt like when Eric Wilkerson received that call from Scholastic Inc. and Kaepernick Publishing, selecting him to illustrate I Color Myself Different. While Kaepernick was enjoying success as a three-sport athlete at John H. Pitchman High School in California, Wilkerson was developing his craft at the School of the Visual Arts in New York City. He has created art for film, TV, advertising, publishing, comics, and video games. Also, he has taught in the illustration department at Syracuse University. He has been invited to lecture at Syracuse University Visual Communication Symposium, Fasten Institute of Technology, and in classes at the School of Visual Arts. When asked why he chose Wilkerson, Kaepernick said, and we quote, "His attention to detail and precision in character development is second to none. He expertly helped to transform a complex story about identity, adoption, and self-love into something visually stunning." End of quote. Recently, In Black America spoke with Eric Wilkerson.
The first thing I remember vividly drawing was a Santa Claus drawing. It was a drawing of Santa Claus that we had to cut out, and it was supposed to be like a door ornament for Christmas. And it was about the size of a baby doll. And I drew Santa Claus at the beach, so he's just got like swim trunks on and the hat and the mm-hmm. and the Christmas hat, the Santa hat. But I remember my mom hanging that on the front door of our apartment.
I got you.
And she was so proud of it. She wanted all the neighbors to see it. So whenever we would come upstairs at night from her picking me up from daycare, every time we got to that third floor, I would see my art hanging on the door. And that made me feel special. And I was maybe five, I still remember that. As far as the first piece that I won an award from, well, it wasn't an award, but the first
recognition,
the first recognition I got for my art that made me shout out loud was when I won the my junior high school yearbook cover contest.
Mm-hmm.
So they let the students design the yearbook cover, and I'm thinking, I'm gonna win this. It wasn't even like a ego thing. I just said it was as a confidence thing. I'm gonna win this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I submitted my piece. It was like a superhero mascot for the school, and kids running alongside him, and like the whole thing, like a comic book cover. And when they announced my name on the loudspeaker, I just shouted like,
"You know?" did.
And it was one of those moments where I just knew, like, I could do this. And I just had really supportive, like I said, I had a really supportive family structure and art teachers in school, in public school, that never told me, mm-hmm. well, maybe you should be a dentist, maybe you should do
right.
this or that.
I got you. So you graduated from the School of Visual Arts in New York. Is there an application process, or do you have to audition, or they just pick talented individuals from the state?
You know what? I don't know how they do it right now, mm-hmm. but 24 years ago, it was an audition. It was a portfolio review, and they just weren't letting anybody up in that school. You had to prove that you belonged.
They didn't. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I remember the day of my portfolio review, the anxiety kicked in, mm-hmm. the nervousness. I was so tense that my shoulders, my back, all tensed up, knotted up. And I was a mess riding the train into Grand Central to get mm-hmm. to New York City and do my review. But after the review, all of that washed away, and I knew I got in. I knew that they were going to accept me, and it was just the reaction from the portfolio, the counselor or whatever, the submissions person that was reviewing my stuff. And I stood there proudly explaining my process and what went into developing the pieces of art that I was showing them,
mm-hmm.
and that was it. But
So once you were accepted, what skills were honed while you were attending the School of Visual Arts?
Oh, I mean, everything. My understanding of color, composition,
mm-hmm.
Light, anatomy, perspective. I mean, I thought I was good, but I was in a school. That's the thing about going to an arts college or an arts
mm-hmm,
school.
Mm-hmm.
You may have been the best at your public school.
Right.
But when you go to an art college, you're one of, you're among every kid in there was the best at their school.
Uh-huh.
So now you're just regular again.
Exactly.
It's weird, but everybody there was the best in their school. It's a weird thing, but we all learned. We were all like basic photography, digital mm-hmm. painting. We were prepared in every way, shape, and form before we went out the door, to pursue a career in the arts.
Before we talk about your current project, as of today, by the time they hear this program, you'll probably be on another project. Talk to us about the long-running science fiction convention. I found that just fascinating to read about you being one of the first artists of color in nearly 60 years at the event.
For Worldcon.
Right.
I think. Yeah, so there's a convention coming up called Worldcon. It's Worldcon 80, I think it is. I can't remember what. I mean, it's the longest. It's probably one of the longest running literary sci-fi conventions
mm-hmm.
On the planet, and it's going to be in Chicago this year, Labor Day weekend, and yeah, I'm one of a few artist guests that are going to be in attendance and showcasing our work. But yeah, this sci-fi fantasy illustration is not typically a career path that you see African-American artists going into.
Exactly.
You see a lot of children's book illustrators, you see comic book artists, you see fine artists, but this is you, this for, I mean, I'll just say illustration in general is a career path that you don't typically see African-Americans getting into.
So what drew you to that genre?
It was, I always loved sci-fi. My father, my father took me to see my first Star Trek movie. I had never heard of Star Trek. I had never heard of Star Trek before he took me to see Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. That's the dates me for anybody listening to this. Like, oh man, he's pretty old. But I sat there and I said, oh my goodness, this is amazing. And then that summer, the next year, Star Trek The Next Generation hit the airwaves, and I thought, there's more of this? Oh my goodness. And that just spawned a whole lifetime of me reading and you know, absorbing as much sci-fi fantasy content as I could. You know, when my mom would take us to the mall, she could go shopping in peace because she knew I was going to be in one corner of Walden Books.
I heard that.
Staring at the comics, reading the, you know, looking at the comic book covers, looking at the sci-fi fantasy covers, imagining myself doing that. So, yeah.
I found it interesting when I was reading about, you know, the sci-fi convention, how you go about your illustration and starting with the poses and the lighting 3D models. Talk to us through about that.
Well, with a lot of sci-fi fantasy art, you are creating something that doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to make it, in order to paint it in a realistic fashion, you have to have proper lighting. You have to understand how light affects color and, you know, your shadows and all of this stuff. And so for me, it's really important. It's really fun as well to gather reference or sculpt reference. I'll make little maquettes, which are little, maybe 12-inch tall sculptures that I make out of clay, and I'll do a really detailed sculpture, and then I'll paint it very, very quickly, and then I'll shine a light on it. And that gives me all the information I need to make it look, to make that alien or that creature or whatever it is that I'm going to be painting look as believable as possible. And for what I do for a single painting is what, you know, George Lucas and Star Wars were doing back in the 70s for, you know, Yoda and all of the different, they weren't phoning it in. They had puppets. They had real, you know, they detailed sculptures, real detailed puppets that the actors could, you know, interact with.
Gotcha.
And it lent a level of believability to what you're watching. And that, you know, spawned, you know, what we see today with Jurassic Park series and all these 3D model, 3D visual effects, you know, extravaganzas where you have the human element interacting with all this 3D stuff. It's the same thing, only for a movie instead of a painting. But my whole job is to make the imagined look believable.
I understand. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we're speaking with Eric Wilkerson, the Chelsea Award-winning illustrator and concept artist. And he's the illustrator for Colin Kaepernick's first picture book, I Color Myself Different. Before I go into the project, I Color Myself Different, how is and what is the Chelsea Award-winning illustrator? Who is Chelsea?
The award is named after Chesley Bonestell. He was an illustrator from the 1960s, a painter from the 1960s.
Okay.
So they named an award after him, and it's like in honor of the best sci-fi fantasy art of the year. And so it's, if I had to put it to people that have never heard of it, it's the equivalent of getting like a Golden Globe.
Gotcha.
You know, there's the Oscars, then there's the Golden Globes. It's the equivalent of that, I guess you could say. The highest honor would be the Hugo Awards, which is the equivalent of like the Academy Awards. So if you win a Hugo, it's kind of a big thing for all of sci-fi fantasy entertainment. It's not just for painters, it's for television, for movies, you know, novels, everything. But yeah, that was a big deal for me, and it was a huge honor, considering that there haven't been a ton of Black nominees or mm-hmm. award winners in the past for that particular award. So it was a huge deal.
Well, I'm proud of you. No one else is. Talk to us about your journey with illustrating I Color Myself Different.
Yeah, so that's I got a call to illustrate a celebrity children's book, and they told me who it was for, and I my jaw dropped.
Mm-hmm.
And we communicated via Zoom and the phone chats and all that, and I poured my whole self into that, because back in SVA, they trained us for everything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they had classes for children's book illustration, storyboards, animation, all kinds of stuff. And I took classes that would prepare me for the possibility of doing a children's book. I didn't know it was ever going to happen, but if it did, I was ready to do it. And so when Scholastic and Colin chose me for this, I knew exactly what to do. It was just about finding the right style for what a young Colin Kaepernick was going to look like. And we hit the ground running.
Was this your first children's picture book? And if so, what was the most difficult aspects of it?
Yes, it was my first children's book. And I don't want to say anything was difficult. I never say anything is mm-hmm. difficult. I say it's time consuming.
Or challenging.
Because I'm eventually going to find the answer or figure it out.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But it's going to take time. So I'm coming from making everything photorealistic and designing all these creatures and stuff. And so when they said, okay, we need a cute character, a stylized character, I'd done stuff like that in my sketchbooks, but I had produced children's book samples maybe a good 15 years prior to this, but I was trying to do a subject matter within children's books that there was no market for.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I just kind of abandoned it. But those were the samples that they showed to Colin and to Scholastic, and that proved to them that I could do the job. So I was really happy that I took the time years ago to dabble in like a stylization. But the reason I say all that is because it was challenging for me to switch gears in my brain to doing something cute and kid friendly. That was the switch. So that was, if you want to say difficulty, that was the most difficult part, was making that switch in my head. Mm-hmm. But once I did, and I knew what style I was going to go with for every single page, the thing just painted itself.
So were you able to talk to Colin, or it was just his team and Scholastic that you communicated with?
I was talking with everybody, his team, Scholastic, and it was a whole labor of love for everybody involved, and making sure that the pages were what Colin wanted to see, what Scholastic wanted to see, and making sure everybody was happy with it. And I was a real learning process for me, because I didn't know, there's a number of things that I wasn't really aware of, but mm-hmm. I kind of just learned on the job. So I was really honored that they gave me that opportunity, because they could have gone with anybody.
Right. Did they tell you how they found you?
My agent. Like with children's books, especially with celebrity children's books, they just don't randomly sift through the internet.
Exactly. That's why I asked. Yeah.
Yeah. So if somebody's out there thinking, well, how do I get an illustrator to paint my children's book?
It
doesn't work like that. Like, it's a high profile thing. When you have an agency mm-hmm. representing you, and that agency pitches you for a job, then that Scholastic or Random House or whatever company it is knows mm-hmm. that you have been vetted.
Exactly.
right? They're not going to say to themselves, the agency and the publisher don't have to say to themselves, well, I guess he'll work out.
Exactly.
We'll see. You know,
let's talk not to when him they have and a, see, right.
Right. Let's foil a wolf. I hope it works out. No, especially when you have a high profile project like this. Nope. So
now, Eric, the book actually details a class project.
Mm-hmm.
Were there other discussions about how Colin and his team wanted to express themselves as I color myself different? Or was this the theme that they brought to you, or were there other ideas on the table?
Oh, no. This is a pivotal moment in Colin's actual life. This this actually happened to him.
Right. That's why I asked the question was, I knew this actually happened to him, but were there other scenarios that were maybe was discussed that were different from what actually the final product is?
If there were discussions for what, I didn't know about it. Like when they came to me, the manuscript was fleshed out, and it was basically, hey, Eric, show us what Colin could look like as a cute little kid.
Mm-hmm.
And then I worked out the concept design of young Colin. We went back and forth over what the hair texture would be, what his skin tone would be, the size of his eyes, size of his nose, everything, every minor detail had to be worked out so that there was a consistency per page.
Was there any resemblance to the teacher?
The teacher
you just made up yourself?
Oh, no, the teacher is actually my cousin's wife.
Ah!
I mean, it's like dead on. It's my cousin's wife, Mary. Hi, Mary.
Okay.
Yeah. They gave a description in the book of what the teacher was going to be. So they said that it was going to be a black woman. And I'm thinking, well, I need reference for this stuff.
Mm-hmm,
let me just ask a family member.
I got you.
And I showed her the sketches of what she needed to do.
Uh-huh.
And my cousin Kevin took pictures of her, like posing a certain way. And they texted it back to me. And I kind of art directed a model shoot through text messages to get the reference for the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I used my daughter as the reference for young Colin.
Right.
And I just made, basically it's my daughter with an afro.
Gotcha.
And and the teacher's family. So
was it fun doing those stick figures?
You know what?
Of the pictures that he made of his family.
That was probably the most fun part of it, because some of those I intentionally had to draw with my left hand.
Really?
So that I wouldn't go too far.
You wouldn't get too professional, right?
I was right, exactly. Like I have to shut down all the things I've learned creatively.
Gotcha.
In order to just go revert back to stick figures and say, okay, well, I don't want to have my daughter do it. But I actually did have my daughter draw a couple of she drew our family.
I got you.
So we are represented on that last page. So it's all of us and our son. She did our whole family. And I had one of our other cousins, a little girl, her name was Gretchen. She drew her family. And then I had to do my version of Colin's family drawing, because they never showed me what his sketch actually was. So I just did my own version of it.
Gotcha.
And I had a blast on that. That was really fun.
What was the most fulfilling part about doing this project for you?
Personally, it was fulfilling for me because I proved to myself. Not to anybody else. I didn't really care how high profile or who was going to see it. None of that mattered to me. I proved to myself that I could do it, because I've wanted to do children's books for over 15 years, and it just never worked out. The samples I was showing, maybe they weren't good enough, or I was showing the wrong publisher, or I didn't have an agent at the time, so nobody was really giving me the time of day. There was a number of factors that made me think, okay, well, maybe this is the wrong direction. Gotcha. And I abandoned it. So when they called me and said, we want you to do this, I thought, okay, then you're going to get me full blast, and I'm going to prove to myself that I could do it. So when I, for now on, for the rest of my life, I can go to the bookstore and look on the shelf, look on my bookshelf in my own house and say, I did that.
What do you want young readers or readers in general to receive when they read I Color Myself Different?
I really want anybody reading this to take away the fact that our differences are what make us special, and that you shouldn't let anything hold you back, anyone hold you back from living your dreams.
Eric, one final question. You being a person of color in this industry and in this genre, are you seeing other African-Americans or other people of color as interested as you were when you were at that age?
Oh, there's a ton. There's a ton now. There's whole conventions. There's BlurredCon. There's Schomburg Cultural Center in Harlem has a Black Comic Book Day festival where they have Black comic book artists and illustrators come out, and they're promoting their own independent projects and self-published projects. And there's a lot of people that just said, you know what, if you're not going to show us represented in your mainstream published works, we're going to go out here and do it ourselves. And out of that, a number of really there's been a number of really great success stories with people being discovered by DC and Marvel Comics, or different book publishers and animation studios. And we're out there
okay.
in a way now that I didn't see growing up. And I think that's the direct result of that fact. There are people just like me that were in the bookstores studying the stuff, or in the video store studying the different animations and Japanese animation and all this stuff. And they were inspired to go out there and do it as a career. So I have friends that work for DreamWorks Animation, Netflix, and the different video game studios. We're still a very, very small percentage of us out there doing it, but we're making a footprint. We're making a statement. And that makes me feel really good.
Eric Wilkerson, the Chelsea Award-winning illustrator and concept artist, and illustrator of I Color Myself Different. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archives of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio. From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
I want to believe that we are in a moment now where we're starting to resuscitate and revive this notion of Black media ownership. There was a time many years ago when there were more Black-owned radio stations, there even some Black-owned television stations. The FCC changed the rules. Everybody cashed out. Now, in this country, there are only four Black-owned talk radio stations. You know, when we came online recently with KBLA Talk 1580 here in L.A., we are the only Black-owned and Black-operated talk radio station west of the Mississippi. As I said, there are only three on the other side, so a total of four. In L.A., for example, there are almost 200 radio stations. And before I showed up with KBLA Talk 1580 last year, we launched on Juneteenth. Prior to that, Stevie Wonder, my friend Stevie, is the only one, only Black person that owned a radio station here in L.A. So, again, some decades ago, some years ago, there were more Black-owned media outlets, and then all that changed.
Tavis Smiley, media personality, author, philanthropist, and radio station owner. Recently, Smiley returned to the airwaves as owner of talk radio station KBLA 1580 AM, the only African-American-owned talk station west of the Mississippi. Smiley began his radio career in Los Angeles at KGFJ 1230 AM. After making a name for himself in the City of the Angels, he became a familiar voice to African-American listeners on the nationally syndicated radio show The Tom Joyner Morning Show. Later, he would host his own radio program on NPR, The Tavis Smiley Show, making him the first African-American to host a signature daily talk show in the history of National Public Radio. Eventually, Smiley would segue into television with appearances and shows on BET, CNN, ABC, and PBS. I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, media owner and personality, Tavis Smiley, In Black America.
Somebody referred to me the other day in conversation as, you know, one of Black America's leaders. And I told him, thank you for the compliment, but I've never tried to be that. I am not necessarily a leader. I wouldn't call myself a leader of Black people, but I'm certainly a lover of Black people. I love Black people. And I want to believe that over the course of my career, 30 years in the making now, I want to believe that Black people all across this country know that I love them. Even when they disagree with me or don't agree with my analysis, I tell people all the time, my mama don't agree with everything I have to say. But even when folk, John, don't agree with me, I think they know that my track record speaks for itself. And all I've tried to do in these 30 years of this media space and the media spaces that I've occupied is to try to love and serve our people. I have a very simple definition of leadership, and it goes like this. You can't lead people if you don't love people. And you can't save people if you don't serve people.
At 12 a.m. on June 19, 2021, that is Juneteenth 2021, media personality and philanthropist Tavis Smiley launched KBLA Talk 1580 in Los Angeles, the only African-American-owned and operated talk station in Southern California. And for Smiley, his radio career has come full circle. Born in Gulfport, Mississippi, he was raised in Bunker Hill, Indiana. He attended Indiana University, where he became interested in politics. During his sophomore year, he became business manager of his dorm, as well as a member of the Student Senate and director of minority affairs. On a visit to L.A., he met football great Jim Brown, who introduced him to George Ugly, who worked for Mayor Tom Bradley. Long story short, Smiley became an aide to Mayor Bradley, ran for city council, and lost. For his early talk shows, he's won the NAACP Image Award 3 years in a row, from 1997 to 1999. Smiley's 30-plus career in broadcasting hasn't been without controversy. In 2017, he was accused of sexual misconduct allegations, which he denied. Recently, In Black America spoke with Smiley regarding his new venture.
Born in Gulfport, down on the Gulf Coast, stayed there a couple of years. My father was stationed at an Air Force base there called Keesler. And when I was two or three, he got transferred to an Air Force base in the Midwest in Indiana. So I left Mississippi at an early age. So I was born there, but basically grew up in Indiana, went to Indiana University, and after college moved to Los Angeles to work for the late great mayor of this city, the only African-American mayor of the city of Los Angeles, Tom Bradley. So I moved here to work for Tom Bradley, and my career essentially took off in L.A. after I left the mayor's office. And so I'm now 30-plus years in L.A.'s home after three decades.
Tell us how you got hooked up with BET.
It's a good question. I was doing local radio after I left the mayor's office. I was doing local radio and television here in Los Angeles. And it just seemed that all of these incidents were happening in Los Angeles that the national news media was descending upon L.A. to cover. Things like the beating of Rodney King 30 years ago, the O.J. Simpson trial. There were so many major incidents that were happening in the city that, again, brought the national media to town. And when they came to town, people would ask, who should we talk to? Who should we interview? Who should we spend some time with? And they said, there's a guy named Tavis who's on radio and television here locally, and he's the guy to talk to. And so long story short, that's kind of how that happened. I was exposed to Tom Joyner, and as you know, he ended up being his partner for 12 years. I was exposed to BET. And so much of that happened in part because of all the national media appearances I was making, talking about these various cases and issues that were happening here in Los Angeles.
Being a part of the industry for such a long time, what have you seen change for the good or for the bad?
Great question. I want to believe that we are in a moment right now where we're starting to resuscitate and revive, John, this notion of Black media ownership. There was a time many years ago when there were more Black-owned radio stations. There were even some Black-owned television stations. The FCC changed the rules.
Right.
Everybody cashed out. And now in this country, there are only four Black-owned talk radio stations. You know, when we came online recently with KBLA Talk 1580 here in L.A., we are the only Black-owned and Black-operated talk radio station west of the Mississippi. As I said, there are only three on the other side, so a total of four. In L.A., for example, there are almost 200 radio stations. And before I showed up with KBLA Talk 1580 last year, we launched on Juneteenth. Prior to that, Stevie Wonder, my friend Stevie, is the only Black person that owned a radio station here in L.A. So, again, some years ago, there were more Black-owned media outlets, and then all that changed. I think we're in a moment now where people are starting to appreciate and value. I see a lot more people, African-Americans, who are doing everything they can to get into ownership, and not just in media, but I think this moment of racial reckoning that we've endured since the murder of George Floyd has gotten a whole lot of people to take stock of what it means to do anything, to have anything, to curate anything that is Black-owned. But I think that we may be at the start of a renaissance where we're starting to see more African-Americans, whether it be online or, in my case, a terrestrial station. But I'm starting to see, I think, an uptick in Black media ownership. And ultimately, that's a good thing.
Why is it important for the Black voice to have an ear, to be on the air?
Yeah. The simple answer is there are just some questions that don't get asked if we don't ask them. There's some issues that don't get raised, John, if we don't raise them. There are people who don't get profiled if we don't profile them. And so as is always the case in this country, Johnny, the late, great Johnny Cochran, my dear friend, brother Johnny, said that race is a part of everything in America. He was right about that. He was ridiculed for making that statement, but he was right. Race is a part of everything in this country. And again, there are just some topics that just don't get traversed if we don't traverse them in Black media. And so, you know, I've learned in just the last year since we brought KBLA Talk 1580 online that there's a void, there's a gulf that we need to serve. And after only, 12 months or so on the air now, there was an independent survey done a few weeks ago. So it's independent. I had nothing to do with it, but I'm grateful for the for the data and for the results. But a survey found a few weeks ago, John, that, after 12 months of being on the air with KBLA Talk 1580, we are the most trusted, the most credible, and the most reliable talk radio station for our people in the whole city of L.A. I mean, think about that. You're 12 months in, and you're already the most trusted, the most credible, and the most reliable. And we're growing our audience share every day. So I don't buy that notion that Black people don't do talk radio. They would do talk radio if you program it to their interest. And that's exactly what we're finding. And to be, again, rated the most trusted, the most credible, and the most reliable talk station in this city for Black people and progressives more broadly shows that if you build it, they will come, particularly, again, if you cater the programming to what matters to them.
From your perspective, and I want you to beat your chest a little bit, why do you think people trust Tavis Smiley to a point where you all are the most trusted, at least your program and the station in general?
Yeah, I appreciate the compliment. The short answer is that, you know, somebody referred to me the other day in conversation as, you know, one of Black America's leaders. And I told him, thank you for the compliment, but I've never tried to be that. Mm-hmm. I am not necessarily a leader. I wouldn't call myself a leader of Black people, but I'm certainly a lover of Black people. I love Black people. And I want to believe that over the course of my career, 30 years in the making now, I want to believe that Black people all across this country know that I love them. Even when they disagree with me or don't agree with my analysis, I tell people all the time, my mama don't agree with everything I have to say. But even when folks, John, don't agree with me, I think they know that my track record speaks for itself. And all I've tried to do in these 30 years of this media space and the media spaces that I've occupied is to try to love and serve our people. I have a very simple definition of leadership, and it goes like this. You can't lead people if you don't love people. And you can't save people if you don't serve people. You can't lead if you don't love. You can't save if you don't serve. And I want to believe that the hallmark, or one of the earmarks certainly of my career, is that I've dedicated myself to loving and serving our people. It doesn't mean, again, that every time I say something, everybody in Black America agrees with me. But at the epicenter of my work, the essence of my work is about loving and serving our people, trying to amplify our voices. And I think when people know you love them, they know what motivates you and what animates you, then they trust you. And so I've been very fortunate with all the stuff I've done in my career, from BET to Tom Joyner to NPR to PBS to the books I've written, the State of the Black Union Symposia, my foundation work with young people, all the stuff I've done, I've been supported so beautifully by Black people. But I think, again, it's because they know where my heart is.
You've written a couple of books. Talk to us about the ones that, obviously, all of them are dear to you, but the one that you're most proud of.
Yeah, I think I've done 23 or 24 at this time. And the one that probably means the most to me is the one about Dr. King. It's called mm-hmm. Death of a King. Death of a King, the real story of the last year in Dr. King's life is what the book is about. There have been all kind of books written about King, but this book, Death of a King, was the first and only book written that focused exclusively on the last year of his life. It starts with King in 1967, April 4, at the Riverside Church in Manhattan, giving his Beyond Vietnam speech. And after he gave that speech, he became the most hated man in America because he came out boldly against the war in Vietnam on April 4, 1967. On April 4, 1968, 1 year to the day later, almost, John, to the very hour, they killed Martin in Memphis. So the book literally starts April 4, 67, when he stands to the podium at the Riverside Church, and it ends on April 4, 1968, when they kill him on that balcony at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis. So it's the first, again, and only book that looks at just the last year of his life. As I've said many times, if you think you know Dr. King and you don't know him in the last year of his life, then you really don't know him. He gives the March on Washington in 1963, but he lives 5 years after that. So when we think about King, everybody goes to the March on Washington. Well, what happened over the next 5 years of his life? And as King got more bold and got more outspoken and started challenging America more, he became less and less loved, less and less liked, less and less regarded. And by the end of his life, in some ways, he was persona non grata. When he gave that Beyond Vietnam speech, everything mm-hmm. and everybody turned against him. The Black church turned against him. The NAACP, the Urban League turned against him, and his own people turned against him because they thought he was taking the focus off of civil rights and putting the focus on war and peace. And in King's mind, there was no distinction between the two. I love my people, and I will serve them, but I also have to speak out against violence, not just in our community, but anywhere in the world. And so by the time he dies, Martin was not, you know, as regarded as he had been earlier in his career. But he never stopped speaking the truth as he knew it. So this book, Death of a King, of the 24 books I've written, is the one I think that means the most to me because, as you know, Dr. King is my hero. Mm-hmm. I've said many times, and I believe, John, that Dr. King is the greatest American this country has ever produced. That's my assessment. He's the greatest American this country's ever produced. And so my work and witness is all about trying to make the world safe for the legacy of Dr. King. And that legacy for me essentially means justice for all, love to others, and a love that liberates people. That's his legacy.
Yeah, I understand. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we're speaking with Tavis Smiley, media personality and philanthropist. Mr. Smiley, talk to us about this political climate we're currently living in.
Yeah, it's a dangerous world, John. And I've never seen anything quite like it. Politically, this country is in some trouble. I think ultimately we have to answer the question of who we really are. Who are we really? Not the ideals, the IDEALS that we profess, but when you consider these crazy ideas, the IDEAS that are being bandied about in our political structure and system right now, it's hard to know who we are really as a people. And that's fundamentally what these elections are about. Bill Clinton famously said that every election is about the future, never about the past. He was right about that. But when you look at where this country's headed in the future, one could argue, as I certainly do, that this country, this democracy is on the precipice. My read of history, John, suggests to me that every empire in the history of the world at some point falters or fails. Every empire eventually has its reckoning. And we're always advancing this notion of American exceptionalism, but we never, I think, take the time to consider that we could be on the precipice. We're on the edge. Our democracy is in trouble. There are a number of things threatening our very democracy: poverty, income inequality, economic immobility, threatening our democracy. This domestic terrorism, say nothing of, 9/11 and all the wars we've been engaged in. What's threatening our democracy are these white boys and this domestic terrorism that we are facing. What's threatening our democracy is gerrymandering. And I thought we lived in a country where the people chose their leaders, not where the leaders chose the people that they wanted to serve in their own districts and they draw their own lines. The people choose the leaders. The leaders don't choose the people they want to represent. We got it backwards. And so there are a number of things that are threatening the very democracy that we think we live in. I could make the argument, if I had the time, that we aren't a democracy. We are an experiment in democracy. Some would say we're an oligarchy, we're a plutocracy. But it's hard to make the argument that we are a democracy with a small d in the best sense of the word. So this country's in trouble. And, I'm not calling for anarchy, but when you continue to have this gap between the have-gots and the have-nots, when people are becoming more helpless and more hopeless, this democracy is in trouble. And so that's my assessment, that we've got to do everything we can to save this democracy. Now, having said that, Black folk have always been the conscience of this country. And in times of travail and trouble and tribulation, we've always, saved this country from itself. Put another way, Black people have learned to love this country in spite of, not because of. And so once again, I think it may behoove us, John, we may be the ones called upon to save this democracy from itself.
Are you part of the ownership of KBLA?
I am the ownership of KBLA. Yeah, I did the deal to make this acquisition about 2 years ago.
Talk to us about that process.
Sure. We came online, as I said, on Juneteenth of last year. So for those listening to your fine program across the country, if you download our app at KBLA 1580, that's KB is in Black, LA, KBLA 1580, download the app. You can listen to us anywhere in the world, literally in real time. And people are doing it all across the country and around the globe. Just download KBLA 1580. We came online on Juneteenth, so we just celebrated our one-year anniversary on Juneteenth of this year. The station is doing remarkably well. We've got a great lineup of hosts. I'm on the air 3 hours a day. D.L. Hughley's on in the afternoons. The daughter of the great poet Amira Baraka, Dominique DePrima, does our mornings. I mean, we've got a great, great lineup of talent. And I'm proud of the fact that, we've got about 17 Black women. I mean, there's no station in the country that can make this claim. Because we're a talk radio station 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, we've got about 17 Black women who either host or co-host shows on this station, 17 Black women. So the station is doing remarkably well. As I said earlier, we're the most trusted, the most credible, the most reliable according to a recent survey. And so I'm glad I did the deal. Of all the things I've done in my career, you and I've talked many times in my career, this is the heaviest lift, John, of anything I've ever done. I mean, LA has about, as I said, about 200 radio stations. So it's a very competitive market. And trying to break through and find your audience and get advertisers to respect you with advertising dollars, it's not easy. But again, something is wrong in a country this multicultural, this multiracial, this multi-ethnic, where there are only four Black-owned talk radio stations across the country, given the impact politically that talk radio has. So the plan, God help me, is to build a Black talk radio network. So KBLA 1580 is our flagship station. But I'm hoping as my career continues to unfold, that one of the last things that I would do in my broadcast career is to build a Black talk radio network of stations all across the country that carry Black talk programming every day.
I know you don't like to talk about it as much as one would hope you would, but talk to us about your philanthropic efforts.
Yeah, I believe that you do the work and you love and serve and you don't beat your chest about your philanthropy. Mm-hmm, but I think the thing that I'm most proud of philanthropically is all the work that we've done through my foundation, the Tavis Smiley Foundation, to enlighten, encourage, empower young people and to help them develop their own leadership potential. As I've gotten older, you know, when I met you, I was a kid. I'm in my 50s now, man. So I've been at this for 30 years as a broadcaster in a variety of
Well, posts. I got 20 years on you today.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man. You sounded good, and you're still doing it. You are the dean, as far as I'm concerned. You're the dean. I'm the student. You're the dean, John.
Thank you, sir.
But I meet young people all across the country who came through our program and were inspired and empowered and motivated to become the leaders that they are today. We've got young people that came through our foundation that now work at the State Department. Some are elected officials. Others are lawyers and founded community-based organizations. Others are in corporate America. But there's so many thousands of young people we've trained about what we call servant leadership. As I said earlier, you can't lead if you don't love. You can't save if you don't serve. We've put that into young people, young Black folk all across the country over the years. And now to see them, you know, in leadership positions of authority means a great deal to me. So philanthropically, I've done a number of things. I've done a lot of work on poverty, as you well know. But the work I've done with these young people probably stands out and means the most to me.
Now, when we're coming up, radio stations allowed us wannabes to have an opportunity to come in and sit in and see what they did. Are your station providing that opportunity for young broadcasters, wannabe broadcasters?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We have everything I've ever done, whether it's BET, Tom Joyner, PBS, NPR, my foundation, all the iterations of my work and witness. I've always had very, very aggressive and robust internship programs. We have a very robust internship program at KBLA 1580. And so there are young folk in this building all the time who are helping us in a variety of ways, some in the studio, some in our sales department, some in our creative office. So there are a lot of different positions and opportunities around here at the station where we're trying to train young people. And we're in the process of building some new studios that we're going to be allowing the community come in to use as podcast space. So again, always trying to do what I can to uplift our people in whatever ways are available to me.
Some our listeners may not know that you had a television program on PBS. Talk to us about some of the highlights, interviews that you conducted then.
Yeah, after I did 5 years on BET, 5 years on Black Entertainment Television, 12 years, of course, with Tom Joyner. And I did 15 years on PBS.
Mm-hmm.
So for 15 years, five nights a week, I was honored to host the Tavis Smiley Show on PBS. And it was amazing for me because I started my career, John, in the blackest of media spaces. You can't get much blacker than BET.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get much blacker than Tom Joyner, right?
Right.
And then I was able to transition to the whitest parts of media.
Right.
So I started with BET and Tom Joyner, and then I added NPR and PBS. You can't get no whiter than NPR and PBS. So to be able to do both in my career, the urban stuff and the majority community stuff, It's been a joy for me to show that you can, in fact, be black and bridge both of these worlds. You can do the black thing and you can do the, as they say, the crossover thing, although I don't like that word. Because everywhere I go, I'm going to be who I am. I'm going to be my authentic self no matter where I am, on PBS, NPR, Tom Joyner, or BET. All I can do is be who I am. But I was, I enjoyed the opportunity to do PBS for 15 years. And because, you know, PBS and NPR are what they are, and they speak to such a broad audience of people, there's pretty much nobody in my career between BET and PBS that I haven't interviewed. I've been fortunate to talk to black or white, just about everybody. And so I'm grateful that my career, now just over 30 years in the making, has allowed me all these platforms and opportunities to do what I do.
Before I let you go, Tavis, what are some of the subjects you touched on this past week?
Wow, this week has been amazing. So this week we talked about the Brittany Griner case, of course,
mm-hmm.
and her guilty verdict that found her being sentenced to 9 years. Since that verdict, of course, there are now stories coming out of Washington and out of Moscow that they are quietly working for a prisoner swap. So the good news is, about she got that horrific sentence of 9 years, the good news is they're going to end up making some sort of prisoner exchange. And I think sooner than later, Brittany Griner will be home. We also talked about Breonna Taylor, as you probably heard.
Right.
While these Louisville cops got away with what they did, the city didn't do anything. The state of Kentucky didn't do anything. But thankfully, Merrick Garland, the attorney general, announced this week that 4 officers have been charged in that murder of Breonna Taylor for violating her civil rights. We covered that story, of course. And, you know, there's so many, whatever is happening in the world, we're talking about it. We've been talking about the extreme heat and how that's impacting specifically black people all across this country who don't have the air conditioning and other resources. I mean, there's a story that came out this week. Some black people are spending a third of their income, John, on utilities, a third of their income on utilities.
Tavis Smiley, media personality, author, philanthropist, and radio station owner. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs. KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
This is Rick Adams, host of Ebony Spectrum and the voice of Just a Thought. My previous thought was either strike a blow for freedom or put dirt on your head. My thought today is equal justice. I heard it on the grapevine. When black folk were enslaved on different plantations in North America, we found ways to communicate. Even though we spoke different languages and were forbidden to learn to read, we found ways to resist and triumph. We found ways to send messages by word of mouth, by way of the drum and the grapevine. We survived and thrived through faith in ourselves and in our God, the first OG. Hear this loud and clear. Everyone who hears this message is called by the ancestors to be a general in the G network. That's the Grapevine Network. All Gs, grown-ups, 18 years and a plus, the Gs in the generations, boomers, millennials, and XYZers, the G's that are grandfathers and grandmothers, and of course, all the original G's.